I have the great pleasure tonight of introducing our speaker. And believe it or not, there was somebody here in charge of the aftercare program before Sam. That's the rumor, Sam. There was somebody before you. And her name is Toni, and Toni has 35 years. She just picked 35 years. Not only that, but Toni has just recovered from a near fatal disease, and so she's well enough to be here with us tonight to tell her story, and I'm so happy she was able to be here. So Toni, come up here.
My daughter says I'm still small for my age, so I have to bring this down. Thank you. I'm Toni Curry, and I'm an alcoholic, and I am so delighted to be here with you, and I appreciate Steve inviting me, and he did invite me, I think, a few months ago, and I was not sure I'd be able to be to come out then, so I said, I think by June 4th I'll be just fine, so... And I am. I tell you, I've had two blood transfusions today, and I might just start dancing up here. I am fine. And I was here in 19. I worked here from 79 to 82, I think it was. Had a wonderful experience here, and I was in aftercare. But I want you to know, there's Sam. Sam came along behind me when I left and built an aftercare program that is second to nothing in this country. It is the best aftercare program in the world. And Mary Jean is his assistant, is a part of that too. So I don't want to leave you out either. That's right. And I will tell you, it is God's miracle that I am here, because I was told on September the 2nd of 2009 that I had an inoperable tumor and I had 6 to 8 months to live. So they were wrong. It's already been past that. And it turned out that I was very operable. While I was walking around with a deer in headlights and grieving, my children were on the internet trying to find another doctor who would say something different perhaps. And they found one at Johns Hopkins, and I had surgery there. And when I got to Johns Hopkins, it was December the 23rd, and I was going to miss Christmas. I'd be asleep through Christmas. So on the 23rd, I was to have surgery, and when I got to Johns Hopkins, there was a Christmas bouquet in my room from Sam Anders. I appreciate you so much. So I am here because of the power of God and the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. The very first day that I was diagnosed, I called my friend Dick A, and his wife Barbara, and I was crying on the phone saying, this is what they've told me, I'm inoperable. And I knew that Dick had gone through something very similar. And I had no idea where I was calling. It turned out that they were in the airport in Connecticut, and they were speaking that night at the Connecticut State Convention, and Dick asked for 2 minutes of silence for me. So the first day I was diagnosed, 2,000 people that I don't even know were praying for me, and that is the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. It really is. So I am, I'm in good shape now. I'm still taking chemo, but I'm in good shape. And like I said, after two blood transfusions today, I might dance for you. So So, but that is why this stool is here, just in case I don't dance, the stool is here to catch me. But I am an alcoholic, and I come from a family of alcoholics. And my friend, it's sort of like my friend Hollis in AA over in South Carolina said, you know, I don't come from a gene pool, I come from a gene swamp. And my grandfather, my father, his five brothers, a brother, an uncle on the other side of the family, my brother, me, and I have a daughter who has almost 4 years in the program. And so we are definitely alcoholic in this family. And I watched my father drink, and I was just determined that I was never going to drink. I was just determined. I was so repulsed by his drinking that I thought, I will never do that. And I managed to make it to 21. But, you know, I had the most, my best girlfriend from first grade, Gail, is back there in the back, and she says she would never have known this, but I had a miserable childhood. And I know that now to be the addiction that was waiting to happen. It was just the emotional part of it going on, and it was the addiction waiting for me to become alcoholic. And it was a terrible time. And so when I took that first drink at 21, after having had a miserable grammar school and elementary and high school experience, I show my age, grammar school. But it felt like, wow, this is relaxing. I don't have this fear inside of me anymore. I don't have that terrible feeling that I'm not good enough, that I'm not what everybody else is. I was always looking around to see what everybody else was doing so I would know what to do. I didn't have that feeling anymore. I had some confidence. I felt really good. And so, you know, I had another drink. And I managed somehow to look like a social drinker for 10 years only because of my fear that if I took three drinks anytime or four drinks, I'd turn out to be like my father. And I didn't ever want that to happen. So in the meantime, I had graduated from Georgia State and was teaching school. And I married this young man who had gone to Georgia State too. And we were busy for about the next 5 years kind of developing our careers. And he was in real estate appraising, and he was building a little practice. And so after 5 years, I began to have children in a very laborious and monotonous fashion. I had three babies in 3 years. And so I'm not altogether sure alcohol was the first addiction, but but I did not want to be a drinking mother, and I did not want to be a cigarette-smoking mother, not the funny kind, the cigarette smoking. And so I tell you about quitting smoking after those three babies were born, because I didn't want to smoke as a mother. And that is actually when my alcoholism began to manifest itself. And when I quit smoking, I went nuts, nuts, nuts. And I couldn't sleep, I couldn't eat, I couldn't think, I couldn't do anything. And so I can still remember the day that I was walking at 3 o'clock in the afternoon through my den with a vodka and grapefruit juice thinking, I know this is early to be drinking, but I'm just doing this until I can get over the nervousness of not smoking, and then I won't drink like this. Well, it never happened. It just kept on going. I was crazy. I started back in those days. I have to tell you, there were no alcohol and drug treatment programs. There was nothing like what you have here, this beautiful facility that you have here. And there were only psychiatric facilities and psychiatrists. We were sent to psychiatrists. And that was the ultimate place you went if you had an alcohol problem or smoking problem or whatever the problem was. So they sent me to a psychiatrist, and this psychiatrist said, Mrs. Curry, there are thousands of pills that we can give you, and we just have to find the right pill that will suit you and will work for your particular body, and then you will be all right. And so he prescribed pills. He prescribed Valium. He prescribed Librium, Senequan, Elavil, Triavil, Nembutal, Secanol, Tuinol, anything at all. And I was a walking zombie. And so I wound up in the psychiatric unit of a big hospital over there in Decatur, and I'm the only one who was there who didn't get shocked. I feel very grateful because chemo's done enough to my brain. If I'd been shocked too, I don't know what I'd be doing up here standing talking. But I was absolutely just a zombie on all this medication. And so at any rate, I stopped going. He kept telling me I needed, he'd find the pill. After about a year of that, I said, no, I can't look for pills any longer. I don't want to find a pill, you know, I'm not coming back. And as I walked out of his office saying goodbye and thank you for helping me, he said, well, Mrs. Curry, I'm only sorry you did not use your time more wisely. So I left with those good words to carry through, and then I was in Emory Psychiatric Unit, and then I was sent to another psychiatrist who thought that I had a Thorazine deficiency. And this doctor gave me so many pills of Thorazine a day, and something that I can't even remember the name of to counter the effects of the Thorazine. But, you know, I don't know if you've probably seen people on Thorazine. We look very interesting. We are, you can't just walk, you know. You can't just walk. You shuffle. And so this is, you just shuffle through the day. You shuffle out of bed in the morning. You shuffle off to carpool with three children. You just shuffle. And one day the druggist said, Miss Curry, I hope you are not trying to do too much on this medication, you know. Said, and please don't drive a car. I said, well, I'm driving every day. He said, well, Miss Curry, you really ought to just be in bed on this medication. You really shouldn't get out of bed. Just stay in bed. So that was another experience. And then I was sent to another psychiatrist who I was to see three times a week. And this is what he said to me. He said that I was so ill-equipped to cope with life and that I was so mentally ill that I would never be able to live a day of my life without Thorazine. And if you've ever had to take Thorazine, you know you don't want to live 30 minutes with Thorazine, let alone have to take it the rest of your life. And I felt hopeless because I had gone to the top of the field. And I was failing. I had failed treatment at the top of the field. I did not know what else to do. Well, about that time, my husband was getting a little tired of my behavior. I was not exactly pleasant to him. And so we were headed toward divorce, or it looked that way, and I knew he would get custody of the children. And I loved my children. All I ever wanted to be really was a mother. And here I was not being a good mother because I was not in good shape. So I just thought that if we got a divorce, I would not be able to have them. And so I knew I couldn't drink. I couldn't drink. Well, I couldn't stop either. I could not stop either. So this is where my pattern of alcoholism changed. Because now we had plenty of money for me to go out and buy vodka if I wanted it. We had the money. But in my brain, I didn't think I could be seen in a liquor store or buying beer or wine in a grocery store because somebody might. I was already told I was being tailed by a private detective. And Actually, it was Perdoma who has followed some other famous people in this area out here. So I had told this private detective was following me. I thought, my brain said, I can't buy booze. So I started looking in the grocery stores for other alternatives. And I found Scope, and it had a lot of alcohol in it, and it worked. I found Listerine, Cepacol. Cepacol, it's been so long since I've used any of that, I can't remember the names. But I found all of those and drank all of those, and then I went for the hard stuff. You know, now here I have money to go buy booze, but I'm buying all these horrible concoctions. Vanilla flavoring, it had 68% alcohol. Lemon extract had 84% alcohol. And I'm drinking all of these concoctions, thinking that nobody's going to know. And I'm sure everybody knew, because there was a day that I happened to be standing talking to a man who was in the room, and he said, you know, it's the funniest thing. You smell just like cookies. So this is the shape I was in. And so obviously that was not going to last. My husband was not going to handle that. And I had this one little window to get a divorce and maybe get my children. And I took it. And so we were divorced, and he did agree to let me have the children, and I agreed not to drink. And so I moved out to Dunwoody. The reason I chose Dunwoody is because I did not know anybody out there. I did not know a soul. And so I thought, nobody out here will be able to complain about my drinking. I'll be able to drink and nobody will know it. Well, I drank I went 9 months without drinking. And then for some reason on a Monday, I decided it would be a good day to have a drink. And I drank on Monday, and on Friday, I was having my stomach pumped out at Northside Hospital. That's the kind of alcoholism I have. It is zero or Katie bar the door. It is everything. And so the children were taken away from me. And in fact, I lost full and permanent custody of them in November of that year. And I just thought it was the end of the world. I didn't think I would ever, ever recover from that. I'd had this little window, and I had moved to Dunwoody where I knew nobody. And when the children were still with me, they went to Holy Innocent School over here, some distance away. And I had to go four times a day to pick them up or drop them off. And it's hard to maintain drunkenness in the right state, to go four times a day from Dunwoody to the other side of Sandy Springs and not get picked up or have a wreck or whatever. So at any rate, I thought that I began to look out my bedroom window. I had a double window in my bedroom. And there was this long, low building being built in my backyard. I thought, how lucky, Mary Jean, can you be? I moved out here to the boondocks. I don't know a soul, and they're building this school in my backyard. And I'm not going to have to drive four times a day over there anymore. I'm going to let the kids walk out the back door and go to school, and I won't even have to do anything but stay here and drink. Well, that building turned out to be Peachford Hospital for the treatment. And they read the promises where it said, we will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. And so that is what happened for me. And I was patient. It was the first alcohol and drug hospital in Atlanta. And I was patient number 97. And so I went in that morning not to get sober. I went in to get well enough, medically treated well enough to get my children back. But I left there having heard about AA. I had been to AA meetings, but I had been in cocktail dresses. You know, I wore I had gone to meetings wearing cocktail dresses because I was going to the nightclub after the meeting, and I wanted to be appropriately dressed for the nightclub. So one time I had on, Conway Hunter was speaking at that meeting, and I had on this butterfly dress where if you raised your arms up, the whole hem came up. The dress came up, and it was like you're a butterfly about to take off. And everybody was staring at me, and I thought, well, you know, they must think I'm cute. They must just think I'm cute. Never occurred to me that I might be a tad overdressed. But that's the way it was going, and I did go into Peachford, and I was admitted on a Monday morning at 7 a.m. in a long black evening dress that I'd had on for 4 days. And a wig that they tell me was a little lopsided that I'd had on for 4.5 years. And I must have been a sight to behold as I was admitted in at 7 a.m. in the morning. But they didn't laugh at me, or at least in front of me, they didn't laugh at me. But I will tell you, I found people who weren't criticizing me because I was an alcoholic. I found the same kind of love that you have found in this hospital. I found people who cared about me, who wanted to help me get well, who were right there with me. They were holding my hands. I was in DTs for 3 or 4 days, and I was only 36 years old at that time, and I was in treatment with people who were mostly 55, 60, 65, 70, because it was not common to see a young woman in treatment back in those days. And so I stayed 1 day at a time at Peachford Hospital until I had completed the program. And then I really wanted to be sober. For the first time, I understood it as a disease, that I was not mentally ill. I had a physical allergy to alcohol, as our big book says. And that's the first time I'd ever heard that. I had never heard anything about a disease other than it being a mental disease. And they said, no, it's a physical disease. It's an allergy. And I just learned so much there, like you learn here in this wonderful hospital. And so when I was discharged, I just kind of could walk across the woods there, and I'd be in my back and on my patio. So it was real easy for me, and I really wanted to stay sober. And I did stay sober for 10 months and relapsed on New Year's Eve that year. I had followed the program. I went to a meeting every single day. I had two sponsors. Actually, I had three sponsors at that time. And they were actually, I had five sponsors at that time, come to think of it. And they were not jealous of each other at all. They all said I was sick enough that I needed every one of them. So I had those five sponsors. And my primary sponsors were a husband and wife team. And they were like my surrogate parents. And we lived next door to each other. We worked together. They hired me right out of DTs to work as a nurse's aide in detox. And so I always say I'm just so glad nobody died, because I was still just barely out of DTs. My partner in detox was meeting his drug connection at the front door to do drugs. It was a nightmare. And so thank God nobody died and on our watch. So that's the way it was going. And I was just really loving being in the company of these great people, these people who had been sober a long time and were in the spirit of the program and were teaching me all that. It was a wonderful time. But they said one thing to me that I didn't listen to. And girls, what was that? Stay out of a relationship And so at 6 months, I'm thinking, well, that might apply to these other women. But I'm weller. After all, I'm working at this hospital. I'm weller than they are. And so I can have a relationship. And it happened letter perfect, just exactly like they said it would. 3 months later, he started drinking. I told my sponsor. She said, honey, you've got to get out of that. And I said, oh, no, I'm going to help him. I'm going to help him. And 3 months later, she said, no, you're going to be drinking. And 3 months later, I was drinking. One drink on New Year's Eve. That's all I drank that day. And I didn't have another drink for two and three quarter months. I might as well have been drunk every single day. It took every good feeling I had ever had away from me. Every good feeling. I was a wreck. I couldn't handle my children, whether they were with me or not with me. I couldn't handle anything. I was scared to go to work for fear somebody would know. I was trying to keep it a secret. And obviously, I could not do that. And so 2.5 months later, I got roaring drunk and several more times trying to recoup. But I wound up going back, having to go back in treatment. There was one particular Saturday when I was on duty and I was supposed to go. And I just knew I couldn't go. I knew I still looked drunk from the night's drinking, night before. And I called my supervisor, and she said, I have been waiting for your call. Pack a bag, we're going to Willingway. She came over, and that minute, whatever she was doing, I don't know, she dropped and took me to Willingway. And I've been, that was May 3rd, 1975, and that is my sobriety date. And I just celebrated my 35th birthday at my home group just this past Monday. And it was a wonderful. It is a miracle. But I fell into this program then, and I went to a meeting. I probably went to a meeting every day for 2 years. And I loved every minute of it. I would jump on the bus and go with the patients wherever they were going. Then I'd go to many other meetings all over Atlanta. And in aftercare, I think that's just the greatest job, because by that time I was in aftercare at Petrie. And it's the greatest job because you get to celebrate birthdays with all the people who've been in treatment. So I got to go to AA meetings all over Atlanta, Douglasville, Clarkston, just all over. It was just the most wonderful experience and a great life and a great program. And, the program is just such a miracle. And God is so wonderful to give us this program and to, I think we're the chosen ones. My girlfriend back there from first grade is not one of us. And, she's been doing service work because her niece now is in the program. And she's been driving her to meetings, and she loves AA. She's not one of us, but I can tell she loves AA. So I told her that in AA we call what she's doing service work. So I think she wants to be one of us, and she's just not. It's sort of like my daughter said after my birthday. My birthday was just so much fun Monday night. And my family was all there, and my youngest daughter called me the next morning, and she said, Mom, thank you so much for having me there last night. She said, it was just wonderful. I've never seen so much love in a room. She said, I don't want to say I wish I were an alcoholic, but she said, everybody in that room had your back. And that is the truth. We're all together, and we'd all do anything in the world for each other. So it really is wonderful. So at any rate, I was totally entrenched in the program. And it's really a good thing that I was, because I had some really tough things to go through several years into the program. And that is when my mother-in-law, my ex-mother-in-law, began to call me and say, you need to get your children back. Now, this is the mother of her only son is the father of these children. And she's telling me, the drunk, that I need to get my children back. And I said, Mama Curry, I just can't do that. You know, I'm sober now. I really love being sober. And if I had them back, I might drink again. I might hurt them again. I can't do that. I just can't do it. She'd call again. Then the housekeeper that had worked with me every day that I was drunk, had never seen me sober, she begins to call me and say, Miss Tony, you've just got to do something about these children. You've got to get them back. You've got to. Katie, I can't, you know. I can't risk my sobriety. I can't risk hurting those children ever again. Well, this went on for 5 months, and my sponsors and I finally agreed that for whatever reason, God was pushing me into filing for custody, and I did that next year. And it was very scary because, you know, he was very wealthy. I made, I think about that time, $3 an hour, $2.45 an hour. That's what I started at. That's what I made. He was a millionaire. And I thought, you know, this is something, it's just not going to work. I just couldn't ever believe it was going to come together. And then the kids would come over, and Angie, the youngest one, said one time, Mom, you wouldn't believe what they said about you. They said you were always passed out on the floor with no clothes on. And they said, isn't it interesting? What was it about getting drunk and taking our clothes off that was so appealing, you know? And she said, they said you tried to run Grandpa down with the car. They said you hit him in the face and broke his glasses and cut his face all up. And I was saying, I wanted to be honest. I said, Angie, honey, I know I did all those things, but that's when I used to drink, and I don't drink anymore, so I wouldn't be doing those things. She said, Mom, I know you did all those things, but just don't tell the judge or we'll never get to live with you. So we went to court for custody. It was just the most frightening day of my life. My sponsor, the husband and wife team, were on either side of me. They wanted to testify. Both of them actually wanted to testify, but the husband was chosen to testify. Johnny and Jimmy Johnson, some of you may have known them. They have gone on to that AA in the sky, but they were wonderful sponsors to me. They were just fabulous. And so at any rate, they called him up to testify. They said, Mr. Johnson, I'm sorry, I was testifying first, and I was on the witness stand for 5 hours. So I get to tell you in 45 or 50 minutes, you know, my experience, strength, and hope. I was grilled for 5 hours about my alcoholism primarily. But they heard my recovery too. I told them about my recovery too, and you could hear a pin drop in that courtroom. Because I don't think the people in that room had ever heard about recovery. They knew about drunks, you know, falling down drunks. But they had never heard anything about recovery. And it was really still and spiritual in that courtroom that day. And then my sponsor got up to testify. They said, Mr. Johnson, can you promise us that this woman will be sober next week? He said, no, I can't tell you whether anybody in this courtroom will be sober next week. Great answer. And he said, we cannot predict the future. And within a matter of moments, he had stepped down from the witness stand and had said to Johnny, his wife, Jimmy and Johnny, he said, Johnny, do you feel what's happening in this courtroom today? He said, I believe we have 3 new grandchildren today. Let's go get a cup of coffee and celebrate. And at that moment, he dropped dead of a heart attack. He was gone immediately. It was agonizing. It was agonizing. We we had all signed up to go to the roundup. It was the very first roundup. And we had all signed up to go together, and we wound up going to his funeral instead. And it was the greatest loss, one of the greatest losses of my life. Because they were like parents to me. They were not like, they were not only sponsors, they were like surrogate parents to me. And so it was a terrible time of grief for all of us, for Johnny, for her children, for me. It was a terrible time of grief. And it was a time when I just was zoning through and just asking God to please help us all get through that. And I was actually angry at God for a period of time during that spell. Angry at God. How could you use me to kill this man who was so important to me as my sponsor and like a father to me? How could you do this to me? And God has answered that over and over again, you know, helping me understand that the people in AA helping me to understand through God that I did not cause his death, that it was I did not have anything to do with that, and to help me move forward. So that was really terrible. That was the horrible part of it, of that day. And the wonderful part of that time was that I was given custody of my children when everybody, including my lawyer, said it cannot be done. There's too much division in the two sides. It can't be done. But it was God's will. And, you know, I do know that having raised them to adulthood, that it really was absolutely God's will that we all lived together. We had so much fun, and we had a lot of fun. And while they were there and while they were young, they were fine. When the daughter who's 4 years in the almost 4 years in the program was a late teenager, she became a different person. She changed dramatically. From the perfect child, I always said she was the easiest child in the world to raise and just the perfect child. And she changed dramatically, and for about 20 years ran through every alcohol and drug she could find. And it is a miracle that she's living, and she has such a strong program today that I'm just absolutely so happy to. One of the great joys of my life today is to be able to share the program with my daughter. And it is, we don't go to meetings together, you know, we don't share those kinds of things in the program, but we share philosophy, and it's just the most fun. It's so gratifying. And so my life and sobriety, let me see what time it is here. What time does this meeting end? 8:45? 8:30? That's not fair. what has happened in my experience, strength, and hope is that God has done for me what I could not do for myself. I cannot take credit for a single thing that has happened to me in this program that has made my life better and better. I can't take credit for Alcoholics Anonymous. That was a program God given to all of us. I can take credit for going to AA meetings on a regular basis and listening when people would come back into treatment or into my office and who had relapsed. You know, they would all say many things, but they all, 100% of the time, they all said one thing. And what do you think that was? I stopped going to AA. I have listened to that for 35 years, and I am still in my home group. I still go to a whole bunch of other meetings all the time, and I'm about a gallon low right now because of this condition I've had, so I'm picking up now. I celebrated my birthday all month, and everywhere I went, I celebrated my birthday. And so I am catching up quickly. But I love AA, and God has just given to me things that I never, ever expected. You know, I was, after the relapse, obviously I couldn't come back to Peachford and do counseling. That's where I was headed. And so they said, we don't know. We have to have an aftercare program. We don't know what that looks like because nobody in the country has one. We want you to sit down and figure out what aftercare is, do the research, figure out what it's supposed to look like. And so it was a blessing to me that I couldn't be a counselor, but I could still be around these people in a little room making telephone calls to people saying, how are you doing? And so that's how it all started. And then the aftercare program that I had written for Peachford became a model for programs all over the country. God, that's all in the world that it is. I didn't have a clue what I was doing. But God let that program be a model. And so I had people coming from Los Angeles, from Seattle, from New York, to look at our aftercare program and take it back to their hospitals and copy it. And so we were spreading the word. It was God's way of spreading the word. And so that happened, and then I came over here. Dr. Talbot wanted me to come over here and set up an aftercare program here, and I did that. And Sam and Mary Jean have just made it the best program in the world. While I was here, the University of Georgia came to me and said, we have heard that you would like to get a master's degree, and we know you don't have the money. We know financially you can't afford it. We're going to start a program here in Atlanta, and we'd like for you to be a part of our master's program in social work. So they invited me to be a part and said they would help me do it. And they were very sensitive to the fact that I was working full-time and had three children. And so I got my master's degree, and I've been in private practice ever since. So that was 1982. So I've had a fabulous private practice where I have a specialty in working with families with addiction, but because of the master's degree I was able to get, I was able to work with a lot of other problems as well. And I've just had the most wonderful experience in my practice, and I miss it right now. I have not been able to work since September, but I miss it so much. But it is temporary, because I'm going to be back there dancing very quickly. But it has just been a wonderful experience. And then when I went into private practice, three doctors came to me. I knew them, but I had no idea they were coming to me. And they said, we want you to help us put together a program for airline pilots. Airline pilots are just now beginning to be treated. The FAA is approving of it, and they can go through treatment. And we don't have a program, and we need a program, and we want you to help us put one together. So that's actually how my private practice started. I mean, obviously, you can't work only with airline pilots. You can't do that. So that's why it branched out and was so much larger. But the chief psychiatrist for the FAA called me one day and said, we don't have an aftercare program. This is years ago now, 1982. That lasts long enough for the period of monitoring for airline pilots, which was at that time 2 years. Now it's three and about to be five. And so he said, the psychiatrist said, I want you to start an aftercare program. Well, now we have two aftercare programs, and there are about 60 or 70 pilots in that program. And it has been running since 1982, and it's just been one of the joys of my practice. And so God has brought people to me to have me do something that God wanted me to do. And so I know that because I didn't engineer any of these things, I know that it's what God meant for me to do. And so that kind of thing happened. And then the governor of Georgia invited me to be on the governor's advisory council for mental health, you know, and the first thing I thought of was, God, I wonder if he knows I drank vanilla flavoring. So then he asked me to be on the Commission for Drug Awareness and Prevention. And then he asked me to chair the DUI Assessment Task Force for the state of Georgia. And that task force, some of you may hate me, but that task force resulted in the risk reduction program that is in place today in the state of Georgia. You know. Now, I want you to know how good God is, because in 1973, I was arrested for a DUI in DeKalb County, Georgia. And I came to in a car that was traveling. And it was traveling and at a rate of speed. And I said, "Where are we going?" And he said, "We are going to jail." And I said, "No, you can't put me in jail. I'm a lady." And he said, "Well, lady, you are going to jail." And so, 1986, the governor of Georgia appointed me as the chairperson of the DUI Assessment Task Force. God is so good. God is so good. So, I mean, those are just some of the wonderful things that were that God brought to me. I didn't pursue any of that. That's what this program is about, that if we just do the footwork, the day-to-day footwork, God gives us these experiences to help us to grow in many, many different directions. So, you know, it's wonderful to be here with you. I love Ridgeview. I refer a lot of people here. And I just think this is a wonderful program. And look at all of you people whom I'm assuming have some sort of connection here. And it just makes me feel so good. And, you know, I know what it feels like to have my father say, "Tony, why don't you kill yourself? You're just a burden to everybody." I also know what it feels like to have him on the last day that I saw him say, "Tony, I love you. I'm proud of you." I know what that feels like, too, when I was now sober. And so I've had the good and the bad. The good and the bad. And I know what it feels to have my children taken away from me and be labeled an unfit mother and have people run away from me in droves because they were afraid I was contaminated. And I also know what it feels like to have God give me my children back when everybody said it wouldn't be done, including my lawyer. Everybody said it wouldn't be done, but it was done. And it is this program that if I've just practiced the day-to-day facets of this program, then God has just made my life and so incredibly wonderful. And, you know, a year ago, I was given a medical diagnosis of inoperable and get my affairs in order. But longer than that, I am still here. And the doctors now say they expect me to be cured, which is a miracle. And I have experienced Alcoholics Anonymous. The prayers, thousands and thousands of prayers that have gone up, I have experienced that in a way that I've never experienced Alcoholics Anonymous before. And so it is so wonderful to have that kind of faith that you just know God is taking care of you. So it has been a hard experience, but I have only two more chemo treatments and I'll be through. And I had a... I had a funny thing that happened in the cancer care center the other day is that when my blood, chemo makes you anemic, and so when my blood had gotten so low, and they first wanted me to take Procrit, and so I went on back, they were going to call my insurance company, and they went on back, and I went on back to the cancer section, and the nurse came back there, and she said, "Well, Tony, I have good news and bad news." She said, "The bad news is your insurance will not cover the Procrit. But the good news is the reason they said they wouldn't cover it is because they only cover Procrit for people who are not going to make it, And they have you on a list of people who's going to be cured. Thank you, God. Thanks for having me. I love being with you.
Tony, we're all living miracles, and I really got into the fact that you all the stuff is that God gave you to do, and you were just following what God had planned for you to do, and that's what I try to do in my program too, because without God, I don't know a damn thing.